The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
This morning, I wanted to talk about ethics. And ethics is something that's a topic which is very closely connected to meditation. And so it's a little bit from the perspective of meditation that I want to address this important issue. And why it's the connection of ethics and ethical behavior with meditation is that meditation gives you access to the source of ethics inside of ourselves. So rather than looking at ethics from external points of view and consequential points of view and moralistic points of view, people who meditate will sooner or later come into touch with their heart, their mind, themselves in a deeper way. And in that deeper holistic connection with oneself, one touches the place where ethical behavior has its origins. So whether it's unethical behavior, one discovers that origin in oneself. If it's ethical behavior, one discovers that origin in oneself. And then when we discover that origin in ourselves, what do we do? What happens to us? How does that change the equation? How does that change us to feel and sense those things inside? One kind of way of describing the experience of meditation, maybe especially for someone who's new, but it can happen to people who've long experiences as well, is that in daily life, it's relatively easy to be caught up in one's thoughts and concerns and issues around the world around outside. And if you sit down to meditate and close your eyes, often enough, the experience is those concerns continue. And so there might be that there's something really strong that we want, and so the mind is still thinking about what we want. Or it might be something that we have aversion to or hostility towards or we're angry with, and the anger and the blame continues, and we keep churning out those thoughts and trying to figure out, you know, what we have to do. Or perhaps it takes the form of fantasy. Fantasies can be very compelling, very engaging, very meaningful even for people because of the feelings, associations, sometimes our lives are much better, more interesting, more dangerous than our fantasies than anywhere else, so it's quite compelling to stay engaged. And so the mind churns away in its fantasies, or memories, reviewing memories can be, you know, both very pleasant and captivating because of that, or can be very difficult and painful and captivating because of that. And so the mind kind of gets caught in these things. In daily life, walking around our life, the mind can get caught in these things, but daily life has an amazing capacity to distract us, to interrupt us. And so we do something for a little while, and then the telephone rings, or we have to do this, or that, or talk to someone, or something happens. And so we don't really sustain the activities of our mind for very long. But when you sit down in meditation, you get to have the opportunity for uninterrupted delusion. Or uninterrupted preoccupation. For the purpose of this talk, uninterrupted preoccupation. Uninterrupted desiring thoughts, uninterrupted hostility, uninterrupted fantasy, uninterrupted memories. And you can kind of really kind of get into it. Unless, you know, the teacher suddenly speaks up in the middle of meditation and says, come back to your breath. Oh, okay. You know, okay, well, where was I? You know. And so if you do this for a long time, whether it's daily meditation day after day or on retreat maybe a whole day or longer, sooner or later, the attraction of what we're thinking about begins to wane enough that we get to see what the cost is for doing this kind of stuff. We get to feel that it doesn't, you know, that it takes energy, it's tiring to have this incessant kind of thoughts and activities going on. We can feel that we're actually in some ways disconnected with ourselves the more we're caught up and preoccupied in the world of thinking and thoughts. The more we're kind of lost in the past or involved in the future or fantasy or involved in, you know, desire or aversion or whatever it might be, the more we're involved in that and caught in the grips of those things, the less we're actually in touch with ourselves, less we're here, connected. And so if you have a long enough time to be uninterruptedly doing these things, after a while you kind of catch on how this works. This doesn't feel good. This is not... After a while it gets kind of old to keep having the same fantasies. After a while it feels kind of like tiring to keep doing the same thing. After a while it feels... You feel that doesn't you don't feel quite connected, or you feel kind of off to do this. And so as we begin feeling the cost of how we behave, our mental behavior and activity, then it becomes relatively natural to want to disconnect with that or not be so invested in that, to pull back from that, to step away from it. And a very simple way of stepping away is to step into the clear observation that this is what's going on. To see and watch, oh, my mind is caught up in thought. My mind is caught up in desires or memories or something. And the more clearly we can recognize that that's happening, it's kind of like stepping back and getting a bird's eye view. Oh, this is what's going on for me. And that's a kind of, we're starting to disengage, or I like the expression, disinvest ourselves. Because one of the reasons we get caught up in, preoccupied in thoughts and desires and all that, is because we have invested a lot of authority, a lot of value in the importance of those things. So at some point we begin disinvesting it from it. We don't invest so much importance in this. And so there's a kind of stepping back, and a loss of interest in being so involved in those things. Some people then find, if it's possible, they find it very useful to let go of those things. Let's stop doing it. Not always so easy to do, but even if it's not easy to let go, it's possible to let go of believing in those things so adamantly, or letting go of going full board ahead with it. It's kind of pulling back. And so this the mental noting, the being mindful of it, is one of the ways to not go full board into it and continue it as we are. So as we sit and meditate over time, what's going on with us becomes more interesting. So the example that I'd like to use is that if I'm holding the striker, and I've apologized to those who heard me use before, I'm a very important meditation teacher at 108 Birch Street. And the proof of my wonderfulness is how well I can hit this bell. And so I need to have a really good striker, because I have to make a nice tone. And if I make a nice tone, then certainly, you know, you'll think highly of me. And the striker is really necessary for that. And so I'm really caught. This is such an important striker. And so I'm going to keep this. I'm not going to let any of you take it. And I'm going to hold it really tight. And so I'm caught up in the striker and its meaning. I've invested a lot of meaning and value into this. Tremendous investment. And I'm focused on the striker, looking around, scanning the room, making sure no one else is looking at the striker and wants it. You know, just, you know. But in all that concern with the striker, I am not noticing how I'm holding the striker. I'm not noticing that my knuckles are getting white. not so white? or that they hurt and getting cramped and all that. So but if I turn my attention to my hand and feel the cost of that grasping, it becomes a different story. At some point I begin feeling the holding is, you know, it's not something I want to keep doing. And I begin changing the kind of equation, changing my relationship. And perhaps at some point the primary thing I think is important is not what I think the striker is going to do for me, but rather the fact that I am really causing myself a lot of pain. And maybe it's not worth causing so much pain to myself in my hand just so that you guys can think well of me because I can hit the bell well. Maybe there are other solutions. Maybe I can always have someone else hit the bell. But so this kind of idea that at some point as we sit long enough and just be with ourselves, we start noticing the cost. We start noticing what the impact is on us. We notice how we're clutching our thoughts and ideas and identities and all this. And as we begin shifting the attention away from what we want and what we're thinking about to what it's like to be grasping those things, what it's like to be engaged in those thoughts and desires, then we get a different, we have a different piece of information. If we're angry with someone, what we might be mostly concerned about is them, that no good sucker, and how you're going to tell them something. And maybe you're well justified to kind of give them their due, whatever, you know. So, but if you sit and meditate long enough, after a while, even if they deserve their due, it's just not worth holding on to it. It hurts you to be sitting there and thinking that and concerned with it. And maybe sometimes you have to sit for a week before you finally get the message that the cost-benefit analysis has now expired or something, you know, the benefit of having those thoughts. And so maybe the best thing to do is sooner or later to let go of that investment. You're over-investing. So meditation is a place where we can see these things and learn these things, learn what it's like to hold on to the striker, and then find out the inner subjective experience, what's that like. And then to begin learning to let go, to relax, to shift the focus away from the concerns we have to what it's like to be having those concerns. And for some people, this is a radical, revolutionary change of orientation. To change the orientation away from what we're concerned with in our lives to what it's like to have those concerns. And meditation, as it go deeper, has more to do with what it's like to have those concerns, what our subjective experience is like. And then there's certain kinds of things that we don't want to keep doing it. We want to let go. We want to relax. We want to soften. It's not worth having it anymore. Even if it's justified to have these thoughts and judgments and activities, it just, you know, there's something more. There's something more important to do it sooner or later. I hope you follow. So we come into ourselves in the subjective experience of ourselves. And as we become connected to a subjective experience of ourselves, we start noticing what motivates us, what drives us, the tensions, the wishes, the intentions that we have. And we start feeling what it's like, the quality of those things. So if you want to do something unethical, which in a Buddhist language could be defined as do something that's going to harm someone else. If you sit down to meditate and that desire to harm someone is still operating, you're going to start feeling how off that feels in your system. You're going to feel how tiring it is to stay connected to those kinds of thoughts, those kinds of intentions. It just doesn't feel right. Independent of any moralistic thoughts you have, maybe you're a completely immoral person, and happily so. And you have a good philosophy justifying it. But you sit down to meditate, and even though you're committed to your immorality, your immoral philosophy, I venture to say you sit down long enough, sit in quiet, and really tune into yourself, you'll feel sooner or later that what a drag it is to have those kinds of intentions and thoughts and motivations operating in you. Because it takes work, it takes energy, it takes tension, it takes a certain kind of disconnect with ourselves. So it's not a moralistic thing to touch into the source of our ethical behavior. It's just a kind of a very practical, ordinary thing that happens as we sit quiet and tune in. And then it becomes pretty natural to want to let go of those intentions and those wishes, at least temporarily while we're meditating. And so then we let go of it, or we soften, we relax that part, and then we're in touch with some other part of ourselves. If there are thoughts of goodwill or ethical thoughts of being kind of virtuous, that also, when we sit and meditate, you can feel the sources inside of ourselves for that. And there are a variety of sources inside for that. Some of them come out of the place of open-heartedness, relaxed, being present, feeling holistic in ourselves. And it can be quite beautiful to feel the beauty of ourselves. Maybe we don't want to let go of it as quickly. Maybe we don't have to let go of it because that part of ourselves that feels holistic and open is not work. Nothing's being done. And this is one of the great contrasts between ethical behavior of a mature spiritual person and any kind of unethical behavior, unethical intentions, is unethical behavior always requires effort. Mental, emotional, physical effort. Ethical behavior may require that mental, physical, emotional effort, energy, activity, but it doesn't have to. Ethical behavior can come from a place that's almost effortless inside. Isn't that interesting, the contrast? That unethical always has to involve effort, and ethical doesn't have to involve effort. It becomes almost effortless where it comes from. It's just kind of almost like a natural place. If the ethical behavior and thoughts come from a place of effort, then in meditation, the tendency is to let go of that as well. To let go of the activities, to become stiller and quieter. And some people might feel a little cautious about that because, wait a minute, I was in touch with this ethical side of me. I'm supposed to let go of that too? It's okay, because as you let go of even the efforts to be ethical, I think most people find they drop into a place that is naturally more ethical. The peaceful, relaxed, still place is a place where it just doesn't feel right to make the effort that the desire, have the desire, or the wishes, or the activities to cause anyone harm. And wonderfully enough, I don't know if it's paradoxically enough, that includes causing harm to oneself. And one of the things that's possible to see, this process of self-discovery, as we see what the cost is of our own behavior, is when we are angry with ourselves or criticize ourselves for being unethical, that criticism, that excessive blame, feels bad as well. It's also work. And so there's a tendency of people who do meditation to start becoming much more forgiving and accepting of themselves. Not so they condone their unethical behavior, but rather to kind of maybe accept this is a part of their humanity, not to give into it, but not to kind of pile harm on top of harm, not to pile aversion on top of aversion. So meditation puts us close to the source of ethics, and some people find that as they come in there, that there's a very high standard of ethical behavior that the heart, your heart, will call on for you. Sometimes it's not uncommon for people who do a fair amount of meditation to find out that things that they've done in the past that have caused harm to people, that it comes back and visits them. Meditation is about being in the present moment, right? But we bring the past with us into the present. The remnants, the leftover unresolved issues in our life will show up in meditation. And the unethical behavior we've done sometimes needs to be addressed. And I've known people who have done meditation up to a certain point, and they could not continue with their meditation unless they went and found someone they had to make amends with. And until they made amends, the meditation couldn't go deeper, because it was kind of like that place, some kind of holding that needed to be addressed and dealt with. I've known people who have been surprised by how beautiful or how precious or how wonderful or how pure it feels to have this deeper, deeper relaxation meditation that touches a place that feels quite ethical, kind of ethical purity. I've known people who, including myself, who had no clue that there could be a place inside, a feeling or a sensation inside that could be called ethical purity. And And then sitting, you know, for me, I discovered it through meditation, or meditation retreats. So I kind of like was, wow, that's quite something to feel this kind of sense of purity. So meditation puts us into the source, close to the source of this. As we then want to live our lives, sooner or later, it becomes, I think, again, a natural thing to want to act in the world from the place of ethical purity, from the experience and knowledge, the sense of connectedness to ourselves that we're discovering in meditation. And so there's how it happens on the inside, what goes on with the inside, then translates to how we behave. And in Buddhism, there's no sharp separation between how we are on the inside and how we behave. So that it's not like you can't make a hermetically sealed separation between them. So as we kind of discover some deeper sense of ethical purity or integrity in meditation, then naturally we want to behave better. If we behave better, then naturally that'll benefit us in meditation and this inner side, inner connection to us. And there's a very close relationship then between behavior and our inner connectedness. So what happens in Buddhism is that many people start becoming more ethical the more they meditate. It's a natural thing. The teachers of Buddhism will often like to say, you should be ethical first and lay the foundation for meditation practice. But if you wait too long to get too ethical before you meditate, then, it's kind of, then you're not getting the benefits that come from meditation that helps this process along as well. So one of the teachings in early Buddhism is the idea that ethical integrity, goes hand in hand with wisdom. In fact, the analogy that's used is that it's like washing your hand. For people who have two hands, you need both hands to wash each other. And so one hand washes the other. So the same idea with ethics and wisdom. You need both. Sometimes ethics, your ethical behavior, is supported by wisdom. Sometimes wisdom is supported by ethics. Sometimes ethical integrity is considered to be a small, teeny little seed that you plant in a big field. And then it's nourished and supported by your wisdom to grow into a big tree. Sometimes your wisdom is just a teeny little seed. You don't have much. But it's supported and nourished by your ethical integrity. And then it can grow into a big tree. So the two go hand in hand. And the reason for this is that wisdom in the Buddhist tradition is defined by understanding how not to harm oneself and to others, how to benefit oneself and others. And so there's an experiential reference point for wisdom. You don't have to get a PhD in philosophy to be a wise person. You have to have a direct connection to understanding what causes harm and what doesn't. So if I'm grasping that striker, the wisdom is not found in understanding what the best striker is, and to hit the bell. The wisdom is found in understanding the harm caused by gripping it too tightly. So this is why the strong connection between ethics and wisdom, because if we understand what's causing harm and what brings benefit, then it informs our ethical decision, not on a moralistic basis, but on this experiential basis of harm and non-harm, and vice versa. As we become more ethical, that also gives us more access to understand what causes harm and what causes not harm, because that's the definition of ethics in Buddhism. Unethical behavior is that which causes harm. So meditation, as I keep saying, puts us in the source of ethics inside of ourselves. This is why if you go back to the time of the Buddha, the ethical guidelines, the most common ethical guidelines the Buddha gave for how to live a life, are not what's called the five precepts, which are very famous in our scene, but rather it's something called the ten karmic actions, the ten steps of karmic behavior. And the word karma is a very interesting word because it's often translated as action, but karma, it doesn't really mean action in this early Indian tradition. It's a richer, it's like a religious word almost. It's a richer and more deeper meaning word. And it's more, maybe it's more like it's action that has its source in our inner life. It's action that has our source in our intentions. And so the point, it's pointing back to what's inside, not the behavior itself. The five precepts, not killing, not stealing, not lying, not engaging sexual misconduct, and no intoxication, have to do with behavior. But behavior is only skin deep, in a sense. So the ten skillful actions are meant to take us back into the source inside of ourselves. And so the ten skillful actions are some of the same ones, but not killing, not stealing, not engaging in sexual misconduct, and not lying. And then it also involves avoiding malicious speech, avoiding harsh speech, and avoiding divisive speech. So we're looking, you know, those are, you know, again, our speech, what we do with our, so big consequence. But the last three are the ones that point to the inner life the most. The last of the ten skillful actions are not being greedy, not having ill will, not being hostile, and not having wrong view. And I think that's one of these last three is why these ten skillful actions are the ethical guideline the Buddha most often connected or taught for people on the path to liberation. Because the path to liberation requires this turning in and understanding what's in the depth of ourselves. And greed and ill will and wrong view are considered to be closer in because they're inner phenomena rather than just behavior. And then not only to avoid those things, but also to do the opposite of those, to do the opposite of, so in terms of the last three, it would be instead of greed, to practice generosity or goodwill. Instead of ill will is to have goodwill or compassion or love. And instead of wrong view is to have right view. And this right and wrong view thing is all about understanding harm and not harm. That's the essence of it. So I hope this, so I want to read this, couple of things more about this ethics thing. The early Buddhist tradition, the Buddha, understood the spiritual path as something that could, at some point or other, be a natural unfolding. And the imagery he used, like that of a tree growing, or of a river flowing. If you enter a small, teeny river high up in the mountains, and float down, it goes, you naturally float down to the bigger streams, the bigger rivers, down to the biggest rivers, and finally into the ocean. That's this direction it goes. Rather than an image of spiritual work is by climbing the mountain to the top, which, you know, arduous and hard work, the image the Buddha tends to give is more flowing down the mountain, down to the ocean, or tree growing. And so here is an example of this kind of idea that beginning with ethics. Here this translation is called virtue. For one who is virtuous, endowed with virtue, no deliberate intention need to be exerted as follows. Let freedom from remorse arise in me. So if you're already being ethical, you don't have to kind of ask to be free of your regrets. This is a natural law that freedom from remorse arises in one who is virtuous, endowed with virtue. For one who is free from remorse, no deliberate intention needs to be exerted. Let gladness arise in me. This is the natural law, that gladness arises in one free from remorse or regret. For one who is gladdened, no deliberate intention needs to be exerted. Let rapture arise in me. This is the natural law, that rapture arises in one who is gladdened. For one filled with rapture, no deliberate intention need to be exerted. Let my body become tranquil. This is the natural law, that for one filled with rapture, the body becomes tranquil. For one tranquil in body, no deliberate intention need to be exerted. May I experience happiness. This is the natural law, that one tranquil in body experiences happiness. For one who is happy, no deliberate intention need to be exerted. Let my mind become concentrated. This is the natural law, that for one who is blissful, the mind becomes concentrated. For one who is concentrated, no deliberate intention need to be exerted. May I know and see things as they really are. This is the natural law, that one who is concentrated knows and sees things as they really are. For one knowing and seeing things as they really are, no deliberate intention need to be exerted. May I become disenchanted and dispassionate. This is the natural law. For one who has become disenchanted and dispassionate, no deliberate intention need to be exerted. May I become liberated. This is the natural law. That one who is disenchanted and dispassionate, that one who is disenchanted and dispassionate realizes liberation. Thus, one stage flows into the succeeding stage. One stage comes to fulfillment in the succeeding stage for crossing over from hither shore to the beyond. So this describes a process, a natural flow, a natural movement that over time, it's not like just boom, 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 but as we settle, you know, if we use meditation as the reference point, that as we settle in and become virtuous, inner virtue, integrity, inner purity, that leads to freedom from remorse. That leads to a certain kind of gladness and happiness. It allows us to relax more deeply and become tranquil. There's a way in which becoming more deeply and tranquil in meditation gives birth to happiness. As we become happy and tranquil, more concentration arises, more focus and stability. And then with that deeper stability, we start seeing more clearly in deep ways, deep into our own minds and hearts. The deeper the seeing, the more we tend to disinvest ourselves from our poor investment choices. And this is what disenchantment means in this tradition. And then as we disinvest ourselves from our poor investments, we discover a better investment. And that is to be free, to be liberated. And it said over and over again in Buddhism, this whole process begins with this, whatever, even the smallest little seed you have of interest in being ethical. Plant and nurture that seed and meditate, and all this will follow. So, that's what I have for today. Thank you.